Hi folks, this is our first recording of our Tortoise Shack Live via Zoom, live from our bedrooms essentially. We were delighted to be joined by Associate Professor in Law and Government at DCU, Vicky Conway, who is absolutely a powerhouse, and she's also on the Policing Authority of Ireland, and Elizabeth Farries of the Irish Council of Civil Liberties, who is specifically, she has dealt with a lot of the issues around data protection, the public services card, and our rights to privacy. We had Caroline West of Glow West joined us as well, and we had a great interaction with you, our listeners. We are hoping to do these a little more regularly now, given that we are all stuck in some way, shape or form. And the only way you can get into us is basically join us on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I mean, for a couple of quid, you get access to these, and you know, you'll get the link. You just click in. We field questions from the listeners and the people who are participants. You know, it was a great thing to try. I think it's well worth pursuing. So, and also it might help us keep these mics going. So if you could and you're interested, head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, and we will hopefully see more of you over the coming weeks. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and we are live on Zoom with a bunch of, all I can say is, miscreants and troublemakers, and that's just the panelists. First of all, folks, it's great that we're trying this. It's difficult times, but I know, for everybody, so we might as well try and make the most of it and see if we can have a bit of fun over the next few weeks. If we can work this out, and it's a big if, I'm hoping to do it a regular kind of Wednesday evening slot, and we'll, you know, you guys are our members, so you guys get first preference, and I think, you know, we have some great guests. We have one great guest sitting on the line with us currently. But first and foremost, Martin, you look very pale tonight. What's wrong?
It's I'm avoiding going out, Tony. It's not difficult for me. I've done it for a while. I'm just, everybody in the same as now. It's nice to live the recluse life, and when we do, we don't get much sunlight. That's simple.
It has to be said, you don't get much sunlight at the best of times anyway.
No. I am glad that everybody's getting over this morning thing. Mornings were always overrated. Look, the revolution starts after the breakfast roll, somewhere around 12 o'clock, okay?
Caroline, do you mind me? Carol, you actually had a positive test for COVID-19, and yeah, you don't feel very well.
I'm weak for post-exposure. Actually, today is the 4-week anniversary of my corona exposure, so that was fun. And I feel like shit. So hence, I was meant to be doing more for this podcast, and I'm just been really lazy and sitting back. So yeah, it's been an experience. Fun, but it's mild.
But you did have a bit of time where you felt better, you were over.
I thought it was fine. That, like, the fever part, the aches and pain, the headaches and the fatigue, I couldn't do like anything, and which is kind of grand because I watched like 3 series of Drag Race on TV, so that was kind of fine. But and then I was kind of grand for the past 10 days, and now the last couple of days I'm like, oh, I actually can't move again. So I don't know if it can come back, but Google tells me it can, which is not a good thing. So I don't know.
I wouldn't mind.
I'm still waiting because my husband has to get his test.
Yeah. We have two Dr. Caroline West and Dr. Vicky Conway, and I don't think either of you are actually doctors of COVID-19. But but Martin, you're
learning now.
You're the internet's most foremost epidemiologist, I believe.
Yeah, well, we were just talking about this earlier. Do you remember a couple of weeks ago, you couldn't say anything and somebody'd go, "Are you an epidemiologist?"
Yeah.
And now the conversation has changed somewhat.
They're all oil barons now.
Oil. It's funny, and it's going through phases where people are, I think it's kind of that 15 minutes of fame thing. People are very bright lights for 15 minutes, so, and then it moves on to the next news cycle and they're gone, and it's desperately looking for the next person who can talk and bring something to it.
Can I just to jump in, Gormley is on the line. She asked me the question about the government, before this kicks off, appropriating culture and arts into how things are operating in terms of this crisis. And you know, because we've seen a lot of artists, we know that the money that's been put up to tide them over is been described as worse as piecemeal. And I've seen artists that I know who have said, look, it's barely worth claiming it to try and get it because of the hassle that it is. And we've seen that also in terms of what's happening in media in a wider sense, there is no, like RTE today were availing of the state scheme just to pay staff. It's a really bad time for people in the arts, and yet we're being told, you know, that it's a great time for PR people and the like. So, like Martin, I know you kind of get a bit gruff about these things, but they are very good at, you know, associating with people, like, you know, Bono's doing this or such and such is doing that.
Yeah, well, I think the arts is so broad. They have a very narrow view, and I'm only robbing from somebody else on this opinion. It's a very Dublin 4 view of the arts. Ireland, pull on the green jersey. It's very Dublin 4 centric, and there's a lot more to Ireland than just Dublin 4. We know that, we've interviewed them. There's some really great people in the arts out there. I feel it's a very rough time for the arts, but I also think everybody has to start adapting to the way it is now instead of waiting for it all to be over, because it may not all be over anytime soon. So don't be waiting to start your life, start now.
That's all well and good, but like if all your gigs are cancelled and you can't get out and actually make a few bob, it's very hard. And I know, Caroline, you had on your recent podcast, you had the Sex Workers Alliance of Ireland was looking to raise money for people who are in sex work, who are just simply their industry is devastated, naturally enough, given the 2K radius, you know.
Absolutely. And it's been really hard to see some of the hypocritical nature of some of the other support services outside of Sway when they say, you know, their response, all their staff are being paid, and what they're giving to sex workers are bags of condoms and like a protein bar or something stupid like that, and a few little bits and pieces. And it's like, okay, that's grand, like, but sex workers can get free condoms anyway, but like what you really need to do is give them money to pay their rent, you know, and actually stop them from going out working and exposing themselves to that risk. So maybe it's time to stop paying your CEO's fancy pants money and actually pay sex workers their rent that the Sex Workers Alliance are trying to do.
Like I've seen, and I know, Robert, again,
has given this family hope.
Oh, sorry.
Someone's gone
and turned on the news. I have another question, which was actually, Vicky, you might even have a say on this. It goes back to an old pod we had when we had Tom Clonin on, and we spoke about the lack of accountability, you know, in our politics and when things, you know, possible consequences for when you say something and it doesn't happen. Someone's asked me several times, you know, and only today I was asked about something about, unfortunately, what it might mean in terms of code of conduct on mortgage arrears post crash, and you know how we have to operate and the legal constraints and fitness and probity. What way could we address accountability in public life, mainly in politics? Caroline, have you any thoughts on that, or should I go straight to Vicky?
Go straight to Vicky. That's not, my brain is like frazzled. That's not my area. So Vicky, take the wheel on that one.
I mean, okay, I'm gonna direct this to what I know, which is policing. And what I will say is, like, so I'm on the policing authority, and the last few weeks have been completely mental. Like, we're just so busy with meetings, with trying to figure out, okay, what's changing in policing, and what does that mean changes for the oversight of policing? And you know, it's been kind of, like, I have regular moments where I'm like, wow, we're actually getting to demand these things of the guards, to say, when you use your power, we want reports. And not only do we want reports, we want to hear X, Y, Z. And I keep thinking 10 years ago, that wasn't happening. That didn't exist. And we have these people that are really, really committed. And it's also questions like? Why don't the guards have more PPE? Why are they being put at risk in the way that they are? You know, who's checking up for their rights as well? Obviously, the GRA system will be doing that. But, like, it just, I have been more convinced of the importance of a body, an oversight body like the policing authority, than ever before. And I think, you know, it's a particularly damaging time when we don't have Dáil committees really sitting, and we don't have those capacities to question politicians in a way that we normally would. Like, that's really damaging for democracy. And I think there's a real issue that, like, and you can say the same with the policing power, is like, we're all accepting a lot of this because we believe it's in the public good. But, you know, you do have to question things as well, and you have to make sure that things are being done for the right reasons, that everything's necessary, that it doesn't go on longer than it needs to. All of that.
I think they're great points. And I think when we've Elizabeth Farries in from ICCL, she can even talk that. But one thing I will say is SIPO, the Standards and Public Office, they do have powers that they choose not to use them too often. They very often choose not to use them. And that's been problematic for a long time. And we only have to look back on the, you know, situations of people fobbing in and fobbing out and heading off to Europe and claiming two salaries and the likes of that. And people saying, you know, that this stuff will usher, just forget about it, it'll change. And now we will, unfortunately, because of this pandemic, some of those things that we talked about pre-election just don't matter now. They've gone to the wayside because you've said, let's just get through this. So it's an interesting question, but I would like to see some form of sanction on people who step out of line. They're, like, code of conducts exist in all workplaces. You know, the phone calls, as someone who's been on the wrong side of the HRAC policy a few times, I know well that these things can have lasting impact. So you need to step up. And I think we need to see leadership there. And what we've seen, unfortunately, is, you know, we've no powers of compellability. And I suppose that would be the big thing I would say. We need to add compellability to SIPO, that they can call people in and that there's a form of sanction whereby it is, you know, you can't stand for public office for a certain term or whatever the sanction is. Martin?
I don't know. You know, I see this whole thing in very long term, in that I don't think it's going away anywhere quickly. I don't think anything's going to happen very quickly. I think we have to learn to live with it and adjust our lives to live with it. In that sense, a lot of things have to change. A huge amount of things have to change, and quite rapidly. And they are changing quite rapidly. So I see these things as steps that look huge, but next week they're steps we could have taken anyway. So I don't get too head up about them at the moment. I think things are in such flux that it's very difficult to predict any kind of future with accuracy. We just don't know which way it's going. I was heartened to see some changes. I am very heartened to see some changes. Even the little change today, which wasn't much for partners of healthcare workers getting paid to mind the children at home, That's a gigantic leap forward, and it kind of just rolled under the carpet very, very quickly, but it's a gigantic leap forward.
Well, I think that goes back to what we keep saying about in terms of no going back, that if we can do these things, we should be able to do them all the time. I mean, we've had emergencies, you know, they said 10,000 people homeless was an emergency. So, you know, it's going to be very hard to undo those things. The last question that I got here, and I'll answer it as best I can, but I won't use the individual's name. But we saw them standing on the steps of the court yesterday, ignoring social distancing, and you know, we've long, and I've long spoken about the fact that we had that individual 3 years ago now on this podcast, and it was very much something around the terms of the Charlton Tribunal, but nonetheless I didn't see how toxic and how bad that was going to become, and how actually vile and scary it's all become. But the question really is, how do people fall down that rabbit hole? Martin, you're the resident tinfoil hat.
I don't know, Tony. I don't know how you fall down that particular rabbit hole. I think YouTube definitely burned it to the ground, salted the earth it grew on. I think that would be a good step forward. I think the algorithm is evil. I think we need to understand that the algorithm is evil. Anything that's driving you towards this, you know, if you go look at your kids' photographs and then 10 minutes later you're looking at Nazis, something has gone wrong. And we need to accept that whoever designs these algorithms is not doing it with our best interests in mind. Mm. What can you do about it? They're just companies. Do whatever you want. We may get to make the rules. We're in a new world. Let's make the rules. Let's make the rules that says, no, you can't do that. You can't link all this stuff together. You can't drive traffic to this. Let's make the rules. We can make the rules. It's a new world. Let's make the rules.
I'd push back and say that you start regulating. Who is the regulator, and where does, you know, who calls... it's just very hard to limit free speech. It is very, very hard.
I'm not saying limit it, Tom.
You are, though,
if you get somebody who's an algorithm that is linking you deeper and deeper into a rabbit hole, deeper and deeper, that's intentional. Somebody intended to do that somewhere along the line. Mm-hmm. And you just take the intent out of it and you say, no, you can't intend to do that.
I agree.
That's not limiting free speech.
It's very easily done as well. I remember when I had them onto me around October, November last year, because they dared to say that our young people deserve to have decent sex education. And I looked at a couple of videos that mentioned me because I had to send them onto the guards and stuff. But since then, I still get YouTube pop-ups on my phone, on my computer from those same Nazis, which is, you know, what they are essentially. But it's I've looked at them, I'd say I probably looked at them about 4 or 5 times, and so months later I'm still getting bombarded with them. So I've looked at plenty of videos on YouTube since and before and after, and I've never gotten that same level of pop-ups available. So I actually think there's a thing about money as well. It's you know, what makes these companies the most money sometimes, and they're going to leave videos up that make some money. So whether or not it's horrendous abuse, we've all seen how crap Twitter is, times of taking down material that look at even anti-Semitic material. We can all look at a tweet and go, that's clearly anti-Semitic. And then Twitter will go, no, that doesn't violate our terms and conditions. And certain people in those forecourts should have been banned from certain platforms a long time ago, but they're allowed to spew these vile racist things because it drives traffic. So it's money and profits and capitalism and all these big structures that are in place. So that's what we need to look at, rather than, I suppose, the individuals as... the individuals are part of that system.
When you have the commander in chief is the worst out of the whole lot, you know, Trump, and he has this massive, massive platform, and he uses it very effectively. And a lot of politicians have learned from Trump about using social media as a platform. They've learned to go direct and cut out the middleman. So when he's getting free rein to say pretty much anything he wants to say, yet if I criticize Trump, and you know this happened, Tony, I get thrown off Twitter. So where's, you know, you can't say it's about free speech. I get thrown off for my free speech. He's calling for, I don't know, fatwas on people, and he's getting away with it. So, you know.
He's good for business, though, Martin, and you're not. He's good for business. No, it's an interesting thing, because I think in terms of the algorithm, the phrase I go back to, I think it was Maria Farrell, who we had on a long time ago, who writes about futures for a lot of tech magazines and stuff, and she referred to not having to eat your greens, that you can just, the algorithm will feed you all the shit you want. And you don't even realize it. Whereas there was a time when we had to we might have had to look at, you know, the news, the front of the newspaper before we skipped to the cartoons. And, you know, there's very much that going on. Listen, I'm going to jump now to our guest, Associate Professor Vicky Conway. Vicky, thank you for coming back on the podcast. The last time you were on, we had a huge reaction because it was around yourself and Mary McAuliffe did the pod in relation to the RIC, and it was one of our most listened to pods actually we've ever done. So thanks for that. But you're on the policing authority and you've delivered an interim report. Do you want to give us a quick kind of overview of what you guys have said?
Yeah, so I guess, the minister asked us last week to provide a report this week. So, you know, it was somewhat hastily put together. But as I indicated earlier, you know, we've been doing a huge amount of work. And I suppose this report, this first report, so there's going to be reports every 2 weeks from the policing authority on how the guards are doing at policing COVID and what our impressions of it are. So what we kind of did in this one is kind of set out our methodology, how we've been doing this. So talking about the detailed engagements we've been having with the Garda Commissioner and his team, but also the outreach work we've been doing with an awful lot of organizations like the ICCL, like Women's Aid, like I think we're speaking to Paddy Point, as many different organizations as we can to get a sense of how these things are working on the ground. And then what we've done in this report is kind of highlight a number of the issues that to date we've been asking questions about. So it would be things like the fact that all of the trainee guards in Templemore were tested early before they'd completed their training. We've been asking a lot of questions about how they're being supervised, what roles they're being given, making sure that they're not, you know, put left on their own in any instances, how soon are they going to be returned to Templemore, asking questions about that. Asking questions about the numbers of times that the new powers are being used. And the guards have released statistics on how many arrests that they've done under the new powers. But there are other powers other than arrest, like asking you to go home or asking for your name and address. And we don't have numbers on those yet. We've been asking a lot of questions about the, I'm not sure if you heard about the spit hoods.
Yes, I did. And I saw you someone mentioned them the other day with the... what they can be used for. I think you've tweeted about them as well.
So yeah, for people that don't know, these are basically kind of mesh hoods that can be put over your head. And like they were kind of created for police about 10 years ago, really around concerns around the spread of hepatitis or HIV, where people might be spitting or biting police. And so these have been brought into guard stations now. And there's a lot of concerns about how they're being used. So the policing authority has been working really hard to kind of, again, to set out a reporting mechanism so that we're told every time that they're used and we're told how long they're used for and where the correct procedures followed. But also highlighting things like the fact that the procedure says, you know, these shouldn't be used on anyone under 12. We're kind of saying they shouldn't be used on anyone under 18. But the idea of putting one of these on a 12 or 13-year-old is kind of horrendous. So, I mean, there's a few other issues I could keep going, but those are some of the things that we were talking about in the report. I'm just trying to highlight, again, the work they're doing around domestic violence, work around Garda wellbeing, the fact that it certainly looks like they're not being given the right levels of PPE, and there's also an issue that guards aren't prioritised for testing. So they're in the longer wait time, which obviously has consequences for the working in the organisation. So we've been trying to dig into all of those issues and see how things are going.
And at the moment, we're still and in terms of the powers, and actually we've just been joined by Elizabeth Farries from the Irish Council of Civil Liberties. So thanks. Hi Elizabeth. Good to see you.
Hey. Great to see you guys. Thanks for having me today.
No, thanks for coming on. Good to see you again. We are just talking about the powers that were given to the police with Vicky here on. Just Vicky, the powers to turn people around and send them home. We've seen videos of people with, you know, filming themselves with leaving a camera on their chair going, what power do you actually have? And blah, blah, blah. Is this just, is it almost, you know, how the power of compellability, like there's been a few people arrested, but they've been kind of more serious incidents. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think the guards are being, they've been very clear. They've made this pronouncement about the 4 E's, that is engage, explain, encourage, and enforce. And that the last thing they say they want to do is to arrest people. So really, the idea of having these powers is to try and get people to do the right thing, to try and get them to go home and or to be within, you know, not to be out if they don't need to be out and complying with the regulations and so on. So the guards are very clear about that. Works in multiple ways. They don't want people in their cars or in their stations and dealing with all the potential threats of that as well. So, you know, we're getting numbers on the arrests, but as you say, we haven't got numbers on the levels to which, you know, they're ordering people to comply or anything like that.
Yeah. I suppose that the main concern that you, and we touched on this earlier, is the fact that we want to see this And I know, again, Liz is here. We talked about sunset clauses and these things. In terms of going back for reports, how often do you anticipate you'll be, you know, looking for updates on these?
Oh, well, we'll be getting figures on the arrests weekly. Mm. And we're looking for the Spit Hut figures or a report every time that happens. I mean, the thing is here, like, it's not just that we want them to stay. We need to ensure that they're being used fairly, that we don't see instances where certain communities are subjected to it more, that certain people, that certain ethnicities, whatever it is, that there's not discriminatory use of these powers in any way. That's really important. And I think, you know, things could get, from a policing perspective, could get more complicated over the next few weeks, because we're going to see these staggered changes. And that, I think that's going to be even more difficult to police.
Yeah.
As the summer goes on and people get more frustrated with all the stuff that's not happening, when they don't have all the sporting events or whatever it is, you know, that will cause more challenges. And I think so far, what we tend to see is quite positive experiences. There's, you know, great pictures of community policing support and so on. But it's really important that it's maintained in that way, and that this is a positive experience, and certain communities don't feel alienated or persecuted by the guards.
Just one last question for me. Just yesterday, what happened outside the forecourts, and I know people outside the courts where people are saying, have the Gardaí commented on why they chose not to enforce the laws as they saw fit at that stage, or am I just kicking a hornet's nest?
Well, the comment that I've seen is that actually the guards responded to Debenhams and forecourts in the same way.
Mm.
So in both instances, the guards went up to the individuals and said, will you please go home? And, you know, the Debenhams protesters said, okay, guard, we will go home. Now, this is what I've seen in the guard's statement, and that the others did not. And the guards did not at that point enforce by way of arrest. This might be a far better place to comment on the propriety of that decision or not.
Yeah.
The policing authority.
I think, though, too, we have to be careful when we call for the use of powers.
Yeah.
I would rather see less than more. I think it's policing by consent, and if you go along with policing by consent, you got to give people, okay, for want of a better phrase, enough rope. And when they've worn out the rope and it's clear to everybody that they've worn out the rope, then you can go ahead and do something about it. But if you act too quickly, you run the risk of being accused of being over the top straight away. So I think it's a balancing game. I think it's very difficult.
I agree with all of that, except for the use of the phrase policing by consent. This has been bothering me in discourse for the last couple of weeks. Policing by consent is a completely British notion about policing. It's how policing was developed and why it was developed in the UK, that, you know, they were only doing what anyone would do in their shoes to protect their community. And that's not the Irish history of policing. It's not our experience of policing.
No.
And I think it's really inappropriate. Then this is, you're becoming the target now of something that's...
No, that's fine. Sure.
But, you know, that's not our history of policing, and that's not how we engage in policing. And I don't agree with starting to characterise policing in Ireland that way.
So do you think it's more policing by degrees? They just take it easy at first, but there is a line where you cross the line, they are going to come down at some stage.
I think it would be much better to talk about democratic policing, where we all agree that this is a rights based, you know, that it's best in everyone's rights and interests to do this. And so we will go along with that. But it's not that we're consenting to what the police are doing. No, we're just agreeing to live in a democratic society.
Yeah, much better description. I'm going to move a little away from you, Vicky, for a moment, and I'm going to come to Liz. Liz, a couple of things we need to talk about. The first one is, and I'm going to go with the easy one first, the public services card, okay? So we'll go with the public services card. Now, ICCL and other people have been working on this for a number of years. And when this crisis first started, there was a demand that you had to have a public services card to access the social welfare services, which got literally overrun very quickly, and they had to drop it and drop the safe two pass as well. Now there's been some reports out of the EU. Will you explain to us exactly what's going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Martin. Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me on. And it's great to be here with Dr. Conway as well. A lot's happened with the public services card generally since ICCL started advocating against it 2.5 years ago. And I think you've highlighted very well some of the major issues that have come up. ICCL has advocated against the system as invasive, as unnecessary. And we were really pleased to have a lot of our views affirmed last summer by the Data Protection Commissioner, who after a lengthy investigation also held that the PSC's overreach was illegal. And now we have a UN expert writing in a really detailed way, Professor Philip Alston, the Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, has sent a 40-page letter to the Irish government detailing how the public services card is de facto discriminatory against social welfare recipients who are in poverty. So this is just another clear signal to the government to scrap this project.
And there has been a finding similar in another country in Europe, exactly the same, that it was discriminatory. I can't remember, was it Denmark? I'm not sure who it was.
I'm going to say the Netherlands.
Netherlands, that's who it was, yes.
And that, I'm glad you raised that, because Professor Alston provided witness testimony to that court case that ultimately came up with a finding of illegality. So Professor Alston has been looking at the digital welfare state for a long time. He's looked at it very comprehensively with a very effective team. And so to have this assessment of the public services card now, especially in the light of COVID, it's really helpful and it's very welcome.
Do we see the public services card ever getting resurrected after this?
I mean, do we want it to be resurrected? No. No, we don't. I understand that the legal proceedings that the government has initiated against the Data Protection Commissioner's findings, those are moving forward. The outcome of that case will have, a strong and binding effect on the public services card. I would certainly hope that it would not be resurrected, but everything that we've seen from the government in response to Professor Alston's letter, in response to the UN Special Rapporteur, is that they certainly don't have any intention of abandoning the system or starting over or making sure that identity cards in Ireland are rights compliant. So that's unfortunate because, with each passing year, it becomes more expensive, rights issues aren't addressed, and it's really a case of just, digging one's heels in and just holding back against sort of the tide of expert advice and findings. So
now it is worth saying that pre-election, there were election promises from other parties to actually drop the appeal if they get into power. So it's worth remembering that. I think it's just worth remembering that.
Yeah, well, I thank you for raising it. As the person who looks at the privacy and data protection issues within the card, I sort of just look at the system itself. I sort of stay out of political decisions that are made in terms of the election, but I do think it's worth raising.
Yeah. This brings us on to, and they're not unlinked, these things will not be unlinked, is that it brings us on to this app that they're proposing to use to, I suppose the best word is to manage the pandemic in
contact tracing, Martin.
Well, it's more than contact tracing, and that's where we're going to get to. It is actually more than contact tracing. Elizabeth, would you fill us in a bit?
I think the contact tracing app, and to be clear, we're not. Are you talking about the HSE app, or are you talking
yes,
about contact the, tracing
the
more generally?
The HSE app.
Okay, I would say that. Where to start with that and how to tie it into the PSC? I would say that both the public services card and contact tracing apps are examples of what is referred to as tech solutionism. There is this idea that you can, if you just get the right piece of code, or if you just engage with engineers in the correct way, you can actually program yourself out of serious social problems. And we've seen that tech idealism or that tech solutionism, within both the public services card and the contact tracing app. That said, I think an app might help. It's an incomplete solution, but I think it could certainly assist. But if it's going to happen, it's really important that the government do it right, that they approach it differently than they've approached the public services card. And I think the way to do that was, in the very first instance, be absolutely transparent on what's going on. And because I haven't been able to sort of comment on the HSE app specifically, because I don't actually know a lot about what's going on there. It's not entirely clear what they're developing. So it would be very helpful to see more information about it, see the legally required data protection impact assessment, see any advice they say they've received from data protection experts. And the reason we need to see that is we need to make sure that the app is actually going to be helpful, make sure it accomplishes what it's seeking to do. We need to make sure the app doesn't actually make things worse, that it doesn't like increase risks to our health or to our safety. And, I'm the surveillance and human rights person. We also have to make sure that it doesn't normalize state surveillance activities to the point where measures which cease to be temporary or optional become normalized and mandatory.
Martin, can I come in there? I just want to let people know that you can submit questions below, and if you aren't off any day off the wall, I will have a look at them. I am monitoring them as we go on. So go on, Vicky. Yep.
Yeah, I just wanted to come in on that because I think there's a really interesting point there, and I'm thinking about like between the PSC, the app, but also these Garda checks where they can ask for your name and address. I think we could all get very used to what actually motivates identity cards very easily in the next couple of months, and we could think it's all very justifiable that the state is entitled to know who we are, who we've seen in the last few months, where we live. And actually, you could come out of this next January with everyone going, identity cards, and then actually the PSC comes back on the table. So I do think that's something we should be really careful about.
I fully agree. The messaging concerns, the people that say we don't have to worry about privacy, those concerns predated COVID. And I agree that COVID, emergency responses to COVID might have the effect of hyper-accelerating state surveillance practices. And we need to be ever vigilant to make sure that compulsory surveillance or de facto surveillance isn't a norm.
It's funny because we, one of the best phrases I heard about this is show me somebody. They always say, well, if you've nothing to hide, why would you care? But again, the truth of that is, well, if you have nothing in your life, well, then you're a nobody. And, that's not, that's just like, mind your own bloody business. Vicky, just in terms of that, the melding now, you touched on our history, and we spoke about it on the previous podcast around the RIC, how we didn't inherit the Bobby on the blue. That wasn't our policing. Can you just give us a quick kind of why we can't have that, what our model actually is?
Well, I'm not sure that we've, as a society, really figured that out yet. I think we have a very unclear relationship with the police and policing. We love the idea of the police. We express really high levels of confidence in the police. We were very proud of community relationships that people have with the rural concept. But then when you go back, I've done fascinating conversations with retired guards who talk about the 50s and 60s, which is seen as this golden age of policing in Ireland, when in fact, they used to do like the agricultural statistics, and they'd call to one farm and the farmer would say, don't worry about what I have, did you know that farmer over there has this many cows? And then the next neighbor would say that about the other. And I don't think we've ever confronted that, really, what our relationship with the police is and what we want them to achieve in society. Because I still think we have that reticence towards, an overempowered police force or an overempowered state that can do too much. I find it absolutely fascinating how compliant we are at the moment. If you told people 6 months ago, they'd be grand with the guards telling them, now go home now, because you're 3 kilometers from your house. Like, I wouldn't have believed it for a second. But we are being very compliant with it. So
I have to agree with you. I think in general, people have bought in very much into this, and we do see it as a societal gain to do it. the idea that it's the guards telling us to stay home, I don't really think so. I think we're telling ourselves as a collective to stay at home. And we police ourselves quite well. You know, Tony as a jogger will have come in for some flack for jogging, and you know, other people doing other things.
He takes his shirt off for the selfies. That's the problem.
Someone actually shouted at me on the Finglas Road the other day, "Put your top on!" I wasn't even. it's getting.
But I think we are handling it very well. I think there's always going to be a bit of fraying at the edges, but I think the fraying that's coming is not coming from the bottom up. I think it's coming from the top down. And I think that's important to say. We're being told there is a message that people are running out of patience, but it's not really people who are running out of patience. It's those who like to turn a book that are running out of patience. And I think it's very important to remember that. And I also think it's important not to be fluhulock with other people's lives. If you're going to say, teachers, at the national newspaper, teachers should show some courage. I thought, yeah, that's only a matter of time until we see that kind of rhetoric here. And I'm not a teacher, but there are teachers in my family. So I'll speak for teachers and say, fuckity fuck, fuck, fuck off. You know, if you want to go back, you go back. Thanks very much indeed.
Like, this is where I think the history of things becomes really, really interesting, because that's a very ingrained British thing, isn't it? About, you know, the war effort and stepping up and treating things this way. So, yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with those statements. I think there is a real community-based impetus to watch out for each other, to ensure each other's safety, but that's not necessarily via the top-down or policing efforts. That's about coming together in a really unprecedented way. And I agree also, Martin, your comments about teachers. I mean, we don't need to call frontline workers heroes. We don't need to congratulate them. We don't just need to put out empty words. We need to ensure that everyone is protected right now.
Caroline, you wanted to come in.
No, you just remind me of, was it the Texas governor or some kind of Texas politician? And he said today, there's more important things than living. Just such a bizarre statement to make. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're advocating for businesses to open back up. And it really just shows the idea of humans as completely worthless and the dollar being more important than workers. And you see that with the clap for the hero stuff. And it's like, you don't clap for them, just pay them better. You know, like, I got an email to go, because my background is social care, and it was, you know, can you do shifts in a nursing home? We're giving you an increased rate of €16.80 an hour. And it's like, that's not enough for the actual labor that goes into that kind of job. And you know, the physical aspect and the mental aspect and what you're actually doing. You know, to be barely above minimum wage to care for our vulnerable people is just not enough. And then in the context of not having enough PPE as well, it's just shocking. Like, the amount of services that are underfunded, and just the hypocrisy of people like Boris Johnson saying, oh, clap for the carers. It's like, you gutted the NHS, so you can fuck off with your claps. Just give them money.
I find the most frustrating thing now is the mood music around the very small number of people who are taking the advantage of the €350 COVID payment, and you're going, well, you know, first of all, that's about 72 euro a week less than the living wage. You know, it's already technically people living below the poverty line, and they're better off on the COVID thing. What does that say to you about the type of society? And we're content to kick them. We're content to make it into this big thing. I spoke to Seamus Coffey about it, who has just left the Fiscal Advisory Council, and he said he's okay with it because, and he made a really good point that I'm going to reiterate now, that the idea of giving someone €350 in a generation of people who, for the most part, are younger people who have already been left behind and are now locked down, it's probably one of the reasons, Vicky, that we have people actually being a bit more compliant, because at least they feel that they're not getting ripped off at the same time as having their liberty taken away, you know? I have one question, and I suppose I just mentioned yesterday, the last 24 hours is Earth Day, really, across the globe, and we've seen all that going on. There are positives in this, potentially. We've seen things mentioned about, that emissions are down, air quality is up, I'm able to run with my top off a lot and breathe a lot clearer. just
it's not a positive.
Listen, I put a t-shirt on. I'm still on brand. The threshold top is on. But just to, if I could put it to you as all, like, do in terms of positive stuff, I know I'm going to focus on the environment. I think there are opportunities here that we can see that when we said the state's ambition of 2% was very, was too low, and people are arguing for, you know, 7%, 7.8% or 10%, as has been argued on this podcast before. We've seen what's possible and how it can actually improve. I think 3 million people a year die from just from dirty air, in effect. They just respiratory problems, breathing, unclean air. This is something that we can actually see that we can have a real impact now. I suppose in your own areas or wherever you want free to, anybody else got something that they think is a positive to come out of this?
Policing a domestic violence. Okay. The whole state response to domestic violence, I think there's a lot more attention being paid to it. I think it's great that it doesn't seem to have taken, you know, people got on board really, really quickly. That was one of the crimes that in a lockdown situation was going to be completely exacerbated. People accepted that really quickly. And we've had, I think, honestly, from what I can see so far, I'm really impressed by the Garda effort and by other organizations' efforts. They're trialing new things, which I think is really interesting. And I'm sure that'll be made public in the next few weeks. But there's some really positive developments in that space. And that's one of those things that I'm like, can we just keep doing that post-COVID?
No going back. Liz?
Also, Caroline, I didn't say hi earlier, so great to see you virtually. It's a loaded question. There yeah. have been a lot of people from a certain demographic talking about how COVID has given them a chance to slow down, to reflect, to engage in practices that their busy lifestyles had prevented them engaging before. And I think that experience is, of course, limited to people that aren't suffering from poverty, aren't being suffering from marginalization, aren't dealing with, as Vicky pointed out, domestic abuse. So the benefits for some aren't there for others. I fully agree with you, Tony, that this pause in economic activity has given us a chance to reflect on climate change, see the benefits of reducing oil-based transport. We are seeing evidence-based outcomes, but even with that, we need to be ever vigilant to ensure that we don't go back to business as usual. And so I'm from Canada, and right now big oil lobby groups in Canada are very quietly asking our government to suspend long-standing environmental laws. They're meeting in secret, they're asking for regulations to be suspended and to have bailouts so that they continue to harvest oil, which, you know, right now is economically worthless. So it's something that we need to celebrate, learn from, and use to leverage different behaviors going forward. And that's going to take a lot of work from everyone.
Caroline.
I think building on Vicky's comments about domestic violence is huge. You know, as someone who works in a refuge and has worked in that area for a long time, the frustration of the Gard's response to victims has been a constant through my whole career. And I hope that the intense nature that has how we see domestic violence and we're recognizing how much of a crisis it is carries on, rather than that level of complacency that I've seen with the guards and that idea of, oh, well, sure, just leave them, you know, and I suppose that attitude has been pretty pernicious throughout a lot of the guards' response. But obviously there's been great guards as well, but I just would like this to be an opportunity for more education to be rolled out as well and across different sectors as well. But I think it'll really change the nature of, I suppose, maybe how women's work is viewed and women who are in homes as well. So we're looking at the idea of childcare and how childcare is impeding a lot of people's ability to work from home at the moment. And, you know, the value of stay-at-home mothers and fathers and, you know, whatever descriptor you're using, guardian of a child, the idea of how undervalued that work has been and work within the home as well. So maybe we can get back to, you know, if we are going back to work, can we look at like how you can actually really support people in the home and how, you know, the nature of caring, and we're recognizing how difficult it is to care for an elderly person now. We might take that a little bit more seriously and either pay staff better or figure out some better working arrangements for people staying at home. Can people work from home like 2-3 times a week rather than going to the office and paying, you know, a grand a month in childcare and trying to figure out that? And so like eliminating that kind of working parent in poverty approach as well. this is just me on a personal level. It's been nice to not do 5 million things. So I do have that privilege of, you know, reflecting a little bit. Like, but of course, I'm literally trying to write an article about what it's like to have COVID and then productivity, because of course, but that idea of like, I haven't slowed down in years and like literally doing 5 million things. And it's actually, I haven't had that chance to kind of process it because I've been ill, but now I'm like, okay, maybe I can actually just take some life lessons and slow down a little bit and kind of, you know, just live in the moment kind of thing. But we live very fast track lives, a lot of us, you know, and we don't actually slow down, and we view ourselves in terms of productivity as well. You know, we measure ourselves up to other people quite a lot, and it's like they've got a bigger car and they go on more holidays and they go like this, and you know, we're now realizing that actually isn't important. You know, it's our human relations, so we might actually treat each other with a little bit more kindness as well. So hopefully.
I'd love to think so. I'm getting more cynical as we go. Two quick questions have come in. One is just a simple one, maybe Vicky, you might know. Is crime down?
As a result, some crimes are down and some crimes are up. So domestic violence and cyber crime and a few others seem to be up. Whereas assault, public order, some suggestion that sexual offences may be down. Mm-hmm. But like all of that stuff has to be really interrogated, because the numbers we get are always, you know, it's what's being reported. Yeah. You know, so it's not, and you don't have the drugs on the streets in the same way.
Yeah. I spoke to Tony Duffin in Analiffy, and he said the big problem is that the people who are on the streets are either looking for drugs that have dried up or, you know, have the limited stock. So we haven't really hit, some of that hasn't really come as bad as it could get, if that makes sense. It's not, and I know some of the bureaucracy has fallen away, whereby the need to give people benzos or whatever it is to get them through, or methadone or whatever the preferred method of helping them over this period. You know, the guys in Safety Net and guys like us and O'Carroll's team and all are on the roads, and they're doing great work there and keeping people and trying to keep a lid on it. The last question is really a brief one here. It's basically saying that, you know, in terms of a briefing committee to address failures and successes post-COVID, I suppose we've kind of touched on it. Vicky, you've spoken about the need for what we've seen in terms of domestic violence to become a thing. Liz, I want to ask you, because the Irish Council of Civil Liberties do a lot of great work, terrific work, and they fought very hard when the government were introducing the emergency legislation to talk about, you know, the sunset clause, when will it be reviewed and how often it will be done. Just in terms of the creep of what is, you know, security creep or tech creep or whatever you want to call it, is there going to be a good way to review this and see how much civil liberties can be pushed back on in terms of a pandemic, if we want to prepare for any future episodes like this?
So how should we look back going forward?
Yeah, I know it's a big one, but just in terms of what we have now, are there structures in place or do you think we'll be able to get structures in place to review them?
Well, I mean, we have the Data Protection Commissioner to step in and correct issues of mission creep. We could certainly bring problems to an Oireachtas committee. If an app is launched that currently is marketed as voluntary, is marketed as opt-in, and if we find down the road that, for example, that app becomes compulsory, because, you know, policymakers begin to rely on them to make decisions about our freedoms, about who can stay in, who can go out, at that time we would need to step in. But I mean, you never want to do this stuff retroactively. That's the major issue with the public services card. You want to do it proactively. You want to be transparent from the outset. You want to get human rights and data protection experts on board immediately to ensure that problems don't arise. I mean, the app is really modeled after the Singapore app, which has been really celebrated as the right way to trace contacts. But, I mean, there are problems even with that app. There's a South Asian advocacy group called Digital Reach, and they say that for reasons unspecified, much of the code implementing core functions of that app, of the Singapore app, including its contact exchanging system, are shrouded or obfuscated, which makes it really difficult for human rights technologists to analyze the code and to see if there are things like backdoor access for surveillance authorities or tracking security weaknesses. So it would just be really great to lay that all out on the table initially so that down the road we don't have to, you know, catch up to ensure that, or to correct problems that have arisen.
I think that's a fair point for all information through this, not just contact tracing. I think there has to be a mindset of complete openness with data so that it can, again, trying to play catch up and then you're going to waste 5 or 6 years with catch up and cover up and, you know, it becomes a game of cat and mouse then after that. Do we really want to waste, you know, 5 years of an administration chasing all of that? Or do we want to say, look, there it is in real time, as best we know, we'll update as we go along and, you know, make of it what you will, add your 2 cents where you think it'll improve it, and we'll try and get it right for everybody. I think there is an aspect of two tentism going on at the moment, and I'll come back to what Tony said about you know, how things get implemented in this country, whether it's policing by consent or whatever way it is.
I can't say that.
There are two tents, and there are those inside the tent and there are those outside the tent. And that's nothing new for Irish politics. That's playing the way they have always played. I mean, to not do it that way would be a departure from old ways. I think if we look, we see what happened with the casual workers and the 350 quid. It started out as a Chinese whisper. Somebody told the Taoiseach. The Taoiseach said it in public. It then gets repeated by the news agents crowd. And then all of a sudden it finds its way into the Irish Times. And this anecdote that never had any substance suddenly becomes the news cycle. So I think we have to be very careful and make sure that all the data is actually on the table before we start. And the sooner the better. Absolutely, the sooner the better. One last thing. Tony said, what did I like about the world? It's quiet. And I like it being quiet. There are no planes flying overhead. I'm not particularly mad on crowds of 5,000 and more, so suits me down to the ground. I think it's lovely to have a quiet world for once in a while and to actually organize a thought. I think it's a great thing.
You see, the Martin is...
Cheers for that.
You're in your element now, you know. That's a bit... guys, look, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us this evening. Again, there's no other questions. Look, I'm going to stop recording, and if you guys want to head off, absolutely. Myself and Martin and whoever wants to hang on, we'll hang on for a few more minutes if anybody wants to have a chat. But I really appreciate y'all being here this evening. And we can't, as I said before, like this is we just tried this tonight. We said we'd see how it goes. So let's see if we can, you know, get something from it. And I hope you all enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Vicky. Thanks, Caroline. Thanks, Liz. Everyone. Thank you very much.
Send in some more sex